Today, I want to talk about thematically some things that Leslie and I have been talking about, off grid here, and it concerns, point of view. And again, a lot of the things that I'm doing during training are sort of really hot off the griddle. So, I'm confident in them, but, take them with a grain of salt and until I really formalize it. It's really sort of right off the top of my head, but I think this is pretty cool. All right. So what I want to talk about is really big, big macro stuff here. And I think the important thing to remember, and I'm integrating these concepts into the entire story grid methodology. So the thing that I've really been focusing on lately is worldview, right? What exactly is worldview? Let's define it. Let's figure out exactly what I mean when I'm talking about worldview. So worldview has two components. And the first component is generally what's the model of the world? How do you see the way the world works? And when I did the Heroic Journey class, I really sort of really got into some massive details about the way I've constructed Story Grid's model of the universe. And that wasn't for just no reason. And it's really about how I have constructed the way in which I'm examining story as a global phenomena. So the model of the world, it could be your religious belief system, which is totally cool. And again, I'm not here to have any philosophical or theological point of view. I want to be respectful for everybody's belief systems. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm recommending a particular point of view. I'm just establishing the point of view and the worldview that I am using to approach story. So you can look at it as sort of like a mechanics way of looking at how a car works instead of like, this is my big philosophical, et cetera. Okay, so with that said, so the worldview of a character and a human being for that matter is how they model the world. And the second component is how do they gain knowledge? How do they learn? What is their model that they use to learn things? So how do they basically upgrade their learning system, their knowledge base? So how does the character understand the way the world works is number one. And number two is how does the character go about learning new things? All right, cool. So for Story Grid, the Story Grid worldview is something like this, okay? So the better we understand the structural, functional organization of stories, the better equipped we'll be to create them. That's generally the worldview of Story Grid. Let's figure out what the structure, the function, and the organization is of stories with such detail that we can reverse engineer them, okay? So what do I mean by structure? All right, structure is the telescopic macro form, right? And all that means is the big picture. So a story has a beginning, middle, and end. A story has a controlling idea. A story is an experience, right? So we actually enter into the simulation of the story in such a way that it entertains and thrills us. All right, so that's the structure. The structure has a beginning, a middle, and end, okay? Now, the organization is the micro, okay? So the organization is the microscopic micro form. So these are things like our five commandments of storytelling, our units of story, all of those sort of like bottom-up processes that we start with. When we want to create a scene, we think about the five commandments of storytelling. When we want to create a sequence, we still think of the five, we bring that all the way up from top to bottom. That's the organizational structure of any unit of story, which is super helpful. And so what about function? So this is the big, you know, this is one of the things that I really get excited about, because I've been playing around and trying to figure out, you know, the function at a very high resolution. So the function of a story, again, this is the story grid worldview, is to embed a compelling, controlling idea such that the audience reaches catharsis as they discover a foundational truth about the sapiential experience. All that means is they learn something, right? They learn something. And they're entertained and they get an emotional response. And it actually feels as if they've experienced the simulation themselves. This is why we cry at the end of stories, or we cheer, or we can't help ourselves but just feel like, holy crap, that was true. Whoa. And we go out to coffee and we talk to our friends about it and we go, you got to see this thing. It's kind of like when, after I got out of Hamilton, I felt like somebody just completely blew up my mind. And I called my kids immediately and I said, you were so right. I'm such a fool. This is the greatest thing I've ever seen. Okay, so the storyteller changes the audience in direct relationship to how effectively they dramatize the change of their protagonists, right? So remember, we attach ourselves to the protagonists. So if we can change the protagonist, guess what happens? We can change our audience. We can have intersubjective relationships with people we've never known and never will know in such a way that they begin to understand the world from our perspective. It's magic, right? We can leave the planet and people, you know, we weren't even on the planet at the same time and it's changing their lives. So this is awesome stuff. So this is the function stuff. And so from the structure and the organization and the function, if we can remember that trinity of stuff while we're working, we can always ground ourselves when we get confused and freak out because we don't know what we're doing. All right, so let me quickly circle back. And this is all gonna get into what point of view and narrative device is about. So hang in there with me. I know this is super abstract and it might seem kind of, you know, like, duh, yeah, that, I kind of get that. But all right, but let's go back to the knowledge framework. Right? Let's think about this knowledge thing, because this is really important. And I think what we are experiencing in a cult as our culture right now is we've lost two super duper important elements of knowledge generation, because we've kind of fallen in love with the scientific worldview, which is, I love science, believe me. But all right, so let me get into what I'm talking about. I've said this before and I'll say it until I die. There are four kinds of knowledge. There's propositional knowledge. And this is sort of, and I like to always sort of think of it in terms of the character so you can depersonalize it a little bit. So propositions, when you're thinking about your protagonist, the protagonist believes the world works this way. So the propositions are, the cause creates an effect. If I do the following cause, it will create an effect. For example, in Silence of the Lambs, at the beginning of the story, Clarice Starling believes that if she goes by the processes by which the FBI instructs young cadets to be FBI agents, and she does really well, that she will achieve FBI stardom, and she will achieve those things that are really super important to her. So that's the propositional worldview that she has. She believes with all of her heart in the institution of the FBI. Cool. So that's what she believes. She believes that if she works hard and does all the training properly and gets the A's in the class, it will cause the effect of super duper FBI agent. This is familiar to all of us, right? Because this is what we're raised with. do the things that the authority institutional figures tell you to do, do it the way they want it to do you to do it, and then everything will work out fine. All right, cool. Procedures, that's the second level, right? So the propositions are mind tools. This is what we think. This is how we behave. And procedures are actually the things that we actualize. So we do these things. So we use an active skill to cause that effect. Oh, so I must study the book in order to get the A. And if I study the book in order to get the A and I do the thing that the person who is in charge tells me to do, I will get the effect of a pat on the hat and a star. That's a procedural skill. The third one, now here's where I think we started to lose it. And this is what story is really so awesome about, because when you do a great story, these last two become extraordinarily effectively obvious to us. And we go, oh, right, oh yeah. All right, so perspective. The way I view the world, my perspective is, I am this sort of problem solver. And I heard my daughter say this the other day, and I was so bummed out because she said, I'm not good at math. And I was just like, oh my God, how do I crack and destroy that perspective, right? Because she's great at math. But that's her perspective right now because she's having some trouble. That's life, right? We all have trouble. So the perspectival knowledge is when you can say to yourself, I am the person who can get good at math. I'm not good now, but I could be, right? Now, your protagonist in your story doesn't have that freaking perspective at the beginning of the story, right? So the whole story is about changing the perspective of your protagonist. So at the beginning, they think the world works one way. It crashes and burns to the ashes by the middle build two. And from that resurrection comes a new perspective. All right, cool. Now, the last one is really super important because the last one has now moved beyond our internal stuff and our external actions and is about interpersonal relationships. So it's the relationships between the subject and the objects in the world, in the field that and the domain that the character is living in, plus the other subjects. So instead of just thinking that the world is me do my thing and I get my cookie, it becomes me do my thing, see how the objects and the subjects around me are reacting to my thing, and then going with the flow. Oh, that isn't landing very well. Let me try something else. So it's these four things are the four quadrants of a story. So quadrant number one is all about how the protagonist is locked into their propositions because they work. They're great, no problem. Quadrant number two, and this is the liminal stage, you move from the ordinary world into the extraordinary world in the terms of the heroic journey as it's traditionally understood. Quadrant two is like, oh shit, I gotta do some procedural stuff now. I really liked it when I didn't really have to do much. Now I actually have to do some skill set stuff. And guess what happens? The skill set fails, like burns down to the core, all the way down to the foundation, and the character finds themselves like basically blowing all their skills up just to get a, you know, lunch, and so it fails in quadrant two. Now in quadrant three is when the dissolution really hits. It's when the character comes to the understanding they will never live the life that they used to live ever again. It's a moment of massive trauma. It's when the character flushes into the chaotic realm. when the world doesn't make sense anymore. Fourth quadrant. Now, the really great thing about that quadrant, which is the darkest moment, is that once we come to the realization that our perspective is off and we let it go and we say, huh, I guess the way I viewed the world isn't working. I guess I'm just going to have to, I guess I either just quit and stay where I am and run back home and hope for the best, or I just continue on. I take whatever the hell happens, I'm going to deal with that then. So it's a moment of real existential crisis. And so the heroic figure goes on. That's all it is to be a hero. It's literally getting up and going to work every day when you don't want to go to work. Even when things aren't working for you, it's heroic. It's like, you know what? It's not working today. Oh, well, I got to pay the bills. Here I go. Let me do my shit. And from that emerges novelty. Because whatever force in the universe that there is that you believe in, there's a moment of grace that befalls the heroic figure. And they create meaning because they start to say to themselves, hey, at least I can, you know, put some oil in the oil tank and figure things out. So at the fourth quadrant becomes participation. And that means that the character stops believing in their old worldview and allows for their new worldview that's foundationally built on the necessity of having to continue onward in such a way that they participate in the world instead of exploit the world. So now they are having interpersonal relationships with objects and other human beings in such a way that they open themselves up to changing their behaviors such that they can attune better. This is a story. This is the whole freaking story. And this is the heroic journey in a nutshell. Now, the antagonist never moves out of their worldview, right? And they're extraordinarily powerful. So you can sometimes, like, I think of redemption stories as an antagonist begins the story, and then they hit this point again, and they finally realize the truth, that the only meaning is the meaning making of themselves in a turbulent world. All right, so what is all this stuff? So that's globally the worldview component of all stories. It's the nucleus. So if a story is a cell, the nucleus is the worldview. So all the operations and all the programming in the nucleus have to change by the end of the story. Now, what happens is the nucleus sends information into the cytoplasm, or like that middle tissue in between the nucleus and the cell wall, and the cytoplasm enacts, it does the things. So the cytoplasm is sort of like our body, like we verbally say things, we take actions, etc. Now, lastly, the cellular wall. Now, without that cellular wall, we're lost, right? We don't know what to take in and what not to take in and how to operate. So the cellular wall is what I call the heroic journey 2.0. This is the deep mythic worldview that our ancestors have passed down to us through story. So all those stories that we find the most compelling have this thing embedded inside of it. So that's the cellular wall. So you've got the worldview in the nucleus, you've got action story in the cytoplasm, and action story broadly means the actions and all of those sort of liminal genres that we love, you know, horror, thriller, crime, those are all flavors of the action component. And, you know, again, I'm I'm going to be doing a reconfiguration of the entire genre idea in a future book, but this is generally where it's going. All right, so what are we supposed to do with all this when we're trying to figure out point of view of our narrator? Like, how does all this help? Well, let's think about it. How can we best, if we're the storyteller, how can we best satisfy the function of the story? Right? What's the function of the story again? Well, it's to embed a compelling, controlling idea such that the audience reaches catharsis as they discover a foundational truth about the sapiential experience. Huh. So if we globally want to talk about the most compelling, controlling idea ever, then we're talking about the heroic journey. So this is a great thing to grab hold on, like grab that thing really tightly. Because when you get confused, you can go back to the heroic journey, and just that those four quadrant things that I talked about can guide you. So so that is the function of the story. But you know, the storyteller has to think about themselves, right? You have to say to yourself, what am I trying to get across? Which requires understanding your worldview. How do you see the world? How do you collect knowledge? How do you, well, oh yeah, that's the hard part, right? Because then you've really got to sort of second order think about what it is you're trying to get people to change, right? Now, a great way of getting there is to think about what sort of genres you're attracted to, right? So if you're just a fantasy nut and you can't help yourself and you buy everything that Brandon Sanderson, you know, writes and you just read it immediately, then something tells me that you really love the heroic journey and that you're really about what it takes to just, you know, keep on keeping on in this world. So that's going to be really helpful. If you love crime stories, that means that you're concerned with justice. You know, why do some people get away with shit that they shouldn't get away with? So these are great sort of ways in which you can start playing inside the worldview and discovering within yourself what's important to you, what you're trying to do. So a lot of people have a hard time choosing a genre because they don't want to go there. They don't want to think about the thing that is really bugging the shit out of them. Because we're all supposed to be nice and positive, right? We're not supposed to really feed that shadow figure within us who wants to rip the throats out of people who do certain things, right? But you've got to go into that shadow world and say to yourself, well, what is it that is really driving me crazy? If I could change one thing about the world, what would it be? And then that value will help you land on a genre. All right. So then what you want to do is you want to say, okay, cool. So what I want to get across is the only people who are really going to solve crimes are the ones who are going to take on the persona of the killer, the ones who will embrace their shadow. This is Thomas Harris in Red Dragon. And it was brilliant. So his hero has a skill that no one else has. He is able to put himself empathetically into the psychic craziness of serial killers. So they call him in to go in and figure things out. So the subtext of that story, and this is why Red Dragon and all the Thomas Harris stuff was so compelling to us, is that Thomas Harris was basically saying to everyone, you've got to go there. You've got to get inside your darkness. You've got to figure this shit out for yourself. Because if you don't, other people will use those tools to exploit you and they will hurt you. So you need to protect yourself by attuning to the way the shadow operates. And so that's how he created the narrative device of that story. The narrative device of that story is using a very journalistic point of view, and Thomas Harris was a journalist before he became a novelist, and to describe that kind of person and how they would be able to navigate an investigation from beginning to middle to end. All right, so these are the means by which you can start thinking about the proper approach to tell the story. So let's go to a really, really great set of tools that Leslie put together in her point of view beat. And these are basically her Socratic questions to guide the crucial decision about how to handle this, how to figure out how to properly, and you know, the most easily for you as the story, how can you figure out the point of view and narrative device? Now, point of view is pretty simple in terms of first person, second person, third person. And there are all kinds of great variants on it that she completely gets into and fleshes out in the beat. So I highly recommend it. But first person is basically, I did this. Third person is more of an omniscient point of view. Now, when you start making the decisions about who the narrator of your story is, ask yourself, would it be better to show or to tell the story? Show means that we don't really feel like there is a narrator, right? It doesn't feel as if there's an overarching person telling a story. It just feels as if it's going. So that's showing. Telling is more of when I was a boy, or like To Kill a Mockingbird is a great example of telling. It's an older person telling a story from when she was a child. And you don't really get that until you see the real beauty of the language and the storytelling. But it was a brilliant idea. Tell the story from the point of view of yourself as a child. Oh, okay, and then there it went. From whose perspective or what vantage point is the story best revealed? So a great device that crime fiction uses is the master detective, right? So the vantage point is from, we get to look at the world from a person who's working with a master detective. That's the Sherlock Holmes thing. So Watson explains to us and tells us how he's experiencing the ways in which Sherlock Holmes is solving the crime. That's a great device. Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby is doing the same thing. So sometimes the sidekick is a great device so that they can comment on the brilliance of the protagonist without, you know, the protagonist tooting their own horn. Who is the audience, or who could the audience be? So who's gonna, and it doesn't, this isn't like a marketing decision. This is more like, who is listening to the story? Who is actually the narrator is telling someone a story. Who is that person? Who is that group? So we imagine that, say, let's say To Kill a Mockingbird, this is a woman who has a child of her own. And probably the child came home one day and was just completely shocked by the behavior of other people. And it was just ridiculous. And so the child was confused and came to her mom and said, I don't understand why this person wasn't nice to this person and why they did the thing that they did. Oh, well, sit down. I'm going to make you a cup of cocoa and I'm going to tell you a story about your grandfather and about when I was a little girl. And then knowing that frame in the mind, the storyteller, whenever they get confused, can go back to that frame and say, I wonder if the little girl is paying attention to the mom anymore, right? Maybe there's something that needs to be done in order to get the little girl to pay attention. So if you know the audience of who is listening to the story, it's really, really helpful. Now, when I write something, I was thinking about this the other day, like, well, who do I write to when I'm writing all this shit about StoryGrid, right? And I'm writing to myself. And I'm trying to explain to myself, and I actually wrote this at the beginning of StoryGrid. I'm writing to myself when I was just starting out. And I'm saying to myself, wonder what it would have been like if I had me from the future telling me everything that I'm going to learn in a way that when I'm 26, I can understand. And so every time I'm writing, I go, oh, that doesn't make sense. How do I know it doesn't make sense? Because I'm funneling back to my 26-year-old mind, and I'm a know-it-all when I'm 26, right? Nobody's going to tell me shit. So the only way my 26-year-old person is going to learn is through a very, very methodical first principle thing. And this is why I'm always about going back to first principles. So that is extraordinarily helpful to me. And it doesn't, you don't necessarily need to know that unless you second order think. And then it makes perfect sense. So now when I get confused, when I'm writing, I'm like, I don't know if people are gonna get that. Then I go, I funnel back to that audience question. Okay, Sam, why is the story being told or shown? So why is to teach. What do you want your audience, what does the narrator want their audience to learn by the end of the story? So the narrator of To Kill a Mockingbird wants their child to understand the necessity of standing up for everyone, for not backing down for anyone. So when that person goes back to school, she will say, hey, that's not cool. Please don't do that, right? And the more people we could have standing up and saying, that's not cool, right? The better things are. That's why that book was so transformational. Because people were like, you know, that really is horrible and not cool. Ah, gotta stop that. So that book, she was writing to, she's probably writing to herself and reminding herself of the beauty of her relationship with her family. But anyway, my point is that you want to know what the payoff is for your audience. All right, when and where is the story being told or shown relative to the events of the story? This is another thing, like what's the best time to tell this story? You know, is this, should I do a historical? Should I do a contemporary? Should I do it happening as it's happening? Or should I have someone reflecting back on what was happening? Steve's Legend of Bagger Vance is an old man telling a story to a younger man about when he was a boy. And the advantages of that is that you know, it could be historical, and he could create a fanciful world that's different than today, and he could fudge some stuff, and it really works. So thinking about when the story is being told relative to the events of the story is a great, great tool too. And in what form, right? Should the experience be one of a written account, spoken narrative, or an internal monologue? So that's another great thing. Like what's the best medium to get this story across? So it could be like in that True Detective television series. It's a interrogation plus flashback, and it works because of Matthew McConaughey. I mean, it was mesmerizing to watch. But the construction was such that if you can get Matthew McConaughey and the other guy, I forget his name, to do Woody Harrelson, to do this project, then it will really work. And that's writing for a visual medium in a way that is brilliant. Okay, so generally, and then I just want to show this last thing, which is actually in the Point of View book. This is a flow chart. This is what Leslie came up with Lori Ayers, who's our great graphic person. So this is kind of a way to lock you down to walk through it in your mind. When you get stuck, even when you get stuck after you've written half of the book, go back to Point of View. And I always say this, I always say, whenever you get stuck, just go back to why the hell am I doing this? And this is even better because you can go super abstract. Why am I doing this? Oh, well, I want to do this thing about justice. Cool. Okay. And then you can start going down this flow chart, and that will help tune in your micro work. So anyway, that's the end of that feature. We have about 20 minutes left for questions. So I'm going to click out of this, stop share, and I will share those documents with everyone. I'll see what I can do about bettering my internet, but it's pretty grim right now. Okay, so did Tim ever show up?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I have a few questions. So this one's from Mark about the Hero's Journey 2.0. As an editor looking to help other writers, how should we translate these new conceptual understandings of the Hero's Journey 2.0 into practical advice for writers? One of our best tools is the editor's 6 core questions, and this is now amended by having the middle build 1 and 2. Are there essential markers or questions we should be looking for to help a writer implement the Hero's Journey 2.0?
Well, yeah, I think the stuff that I just talked about is going to be extraordinarily helpful because as long as you know the big macro movements and the big places from which the protagonist should be operating, you have a pretty good guide, right? So let me just review it again. The heroic journey is simply about confronting, simply, the crisis of existence, basically. And what is the crisis of existence? Is how should I operate in a world in which there is no certainty? How do I deal with that? So it's also about how we must constantly be upping our cognitive capacity. All that means is we have to learn how to be better. We need to level up our shit. So the 4 quadrants are really kind of helpful. So that first 25% of the story, we're going to present the protagonist in a place where they've got pretty much their shit together. It might not be great, but for Rocky Balboa at the beginning of Rocky, he's got his shit together. It's not where any of us would want to live, but he's okay with it. He's got a 6-pack of beer in his fridge. He makes his little bit of money as being a loan shark, and he gets a fight every now and then. And so he can, you know, that's enough for him. He's cool with it. He's a bum, but it's fine. He's got a dog. Everything's cool. So his worldview 1.0 works for Rocky Balboa. He's fine. Thank you very much. Okay. So what happens? Well, he gets a shot at becoming someone else. And he's terrified by that shot. So his propositional knowledge, I'm cool being a bum, has now been disturbed by this opportunity, this visible fear gorilla that drops into his life. It's actually invisible, but the visibility of it is you get the shot at the title. The invisible part about it is you've got to level up. That's what the invisible fear gorilla is all about. It drops into our life and it basically says, it's time to get off your ass and level up. That's it. So that's quadrant number 1. Now, quadrant number 2 is Rocky training. He's applying his worldview. He's doing the procedures. He's getting stronger. He's running. He begins and he sucks and he can barely breathe. But by the end of the second quadrant, he now is starting to feel a little bit better about himself. And he's got a girlfriend. Things are looking up for Rocky. Now, guess what? That explodes his worldview. It destroys it because his worldview is I'm a bum. So he's proven by just applying a little, you know, elbow grease and a little discipline, he can actually improve his life. But that's almost, that is devastating. It's chaotic. Ugh. The third quadrant is when he comes to realize that he's a patsy, that he's been played and that this is a joke and there's no way he's ever gonna beat the champ. The champ is just way, 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 way more powerful than he ever will be. And that's true. It's not fake. So he hits bottom and he has to say to himself, how am I gonna handle this? Maybe I should just quit. Maybe I'll quit because I don't want to be played a fool. But no, he decides, you know what? I'm pretty good at moving on. So I'm just going to go in there and my goal, I'm going to change my goal. So he changes his worldview from I can win to I recognize I can't beat this guy. But what I can do is survive. Cool. Then the whole fourth quadrant is, will Rocky survive? And it's beautiful. So that's the heroic journey. He decides the critical moment in that story is when he goes home and he talks to Adrian and says, I can't win. What do I do now? There's no way I can win. Well, you got to go on anyway. And that is those four quadrants is propositional knowledge that locks us into a worldview, pushed into an extraordinary world that forces us to use all of our skill set to get, you know, to solve problems, which proves to completely disintegrate our old worldview. We can't go back again. We fall into chaos in the third quadrant until we emerge with a novel, new understanding of a new worldview. You know what? Surviving's pretty damn good. You know, there's some pretty beautiful things in this world, and let's enjoy that while we can. Let's make that shit meaningful and not worry so much about how much money I have in the bank. Cool. Then into the fourth quadrant, you apply that new worldview. This is the same four quadrants for every kind of story. And people love this story because it's all we can do. That's all you can do in an uncertain world is make meaning for yourself and for the loved ones around you. And let that be enough, because it is. It's incredible. And that's the freaking point of the heroic journey. It's not to go get a prize. It's not to become Superman or Superwoman or Black Panther. It's simply to respectfully and lovingly move through life in the face of adversity, uncertainty, and inevitable death with honor and courage. That's what every great story is about. So that's all you have to tell your clients. And you will get them excited about it because they'll go, you know what? That's really fucking true. And you go, okay, that's your controlling idea. Don't worry about any other controlling idea. Focus on that controlling idea. And guess what will happen? Another one will emerge that is genre specific. Well, I want to do that heroic journey thing for a story about a young girl who enters a spelling bee. Cool. Great. And guess what the controlling idea of that will be? Just getting in front of an audience is enough. Just having the courage to enter the damn thing is enough, right? So the third party validation stuff, you know, that will prove to be ineffective for her happiness. But it's like the Queen's Gambit story. It's like whenever that woman gets off track, get me into the chessboard. I gotta get into the chessboard. That's my thing. That's my arena. That's my domain. That's where I feel right. Okay. Sorry, I went on too long.
All right.
Any more questions, Tim?
Yeah. This one's from Brendan. In the diagram chaos quadrant, there is a horizontal line with an arrow and a vertical line, which I understand to be the climatic action ladder. What does that horizontal line represent in terms of the five core scenes of the middle build two?
I'm a bit confused by the question. So let me go back to first principles. The vertical axis on the heroic journey diagram and on story grids diagrams represents the subjective worldview movement of the character. The x-axis represents the on the surface. Was this good or bad, right? Good or bad. And so the third quadrant is a situation that terrifies all of us. When we discover more and more shit falling in our life that is bad. So the inciting incident would be something that's really bad happens. In terms of Rocky, it's he starts to believe that he, I don't want to do Rocky right now because it's too fadey in my mind. But there's a lot of negative things that happen in that third quadrant, one of which his girlfriend's brother resents him, hates him. Everybody starts to move against Rocky. Because now he's going to become a big shot. He's going to leave the neighborhood. So all of these things that he believed that, you know, as long as I'm not a bum, people will admire me. He discovers that his social world is actually rejecting him. Once the crab crawls out of the pot, you know, people start to drag him down. So that's what's happening in the third quadrant. And it makes no sense to him, right? Because he always believed if I become a big champ, then all the people in the neighborhood will admire me and go, hey, Rocky. But no, it's not like that. We all know, we've all had this experience. You get a little bit better at something or at work and people are like, oh, what a brown loser. You know, look at them, you know, getting the promotion. They don't deserve shit, right? That's the way it works. So that's the third quadrant. So we start to lose our love. Our worldview completely disintegrates. So all the things that we thought were going to make us happy don't. And the turning point of that chaotic third quadrant is from things are never going to be the same. Holy shit. Nothing ever makes sense to me at all. I'm going to die in the ring. That's the existential crisis that Rocky hits. Look at me. God, am I a chump? I bought into this bullshit from being a little boy. As long as I was the toughest guy, someday I could become champion of the world. No freaking way I'm beating Apollo Creed. That man is above my pay grade at such a level, he will probably kill me, right? That is the turning point. It's approaching death. The inevitability of death. I know this is dark, but it's true. So the character has to, oh my God, I'm mortal. What does that mean? What does my life mean? I'm gonna die. What if I die? What is it gonna mean? That's the turning point of the chaos quadrant. Confronting death can either be literal death or psychological death. And psychological death would be something like, somebody just stole all of my work and they are going to get the Nobel Prize. What did that mean to me? How can I go on when everything I've worked for, somebody stole and now has got the Nobel Prize? That's death. Does your life's work mean anything if you don't get the Nobel Prize? That's the crisis. That's the turning point. You see how it's getting depth, depth, depth. We are going down to the essence of being a human being. What does my life mean? So everything is turning shittily on the literal side. Nobody's talking to Rocky anymore. Everybody thinks he's got a big head. His girlfriend's brother beats her up. He can't beat up the brother because, oh my God, what the hell is going on here, right? And then night before the fight, he goes in there and there's the ring promoter telling him, hey, you're gonna put on a good show, Rocky. We're all gonna enjoy it. Like, oh, you're gonna enjoy me getting beaten to death. And I'm gonna do this in front of this crowd and millions of people on TV. What does that mean? What does that mean? Why should I do that? And then from that depths of shit emerges meaning. Well, I'm a fighter. I'm a fighter. And so that's the whole chaos quadrant. You're bringing that character right to the edge of the existential crisis. And if you can get them down there and it's clear, you've got your reader so tightly by the shoulders that they are not going to leave you. They are going the full distance to see what happens in the resolution. And Rocky could have died at the end of that movie and it would have still worked. Now, they wouldn't have had 5 sequels, and maybe it wouldn't have been there's a great movie with Hilary Swank, and Clint Eastwood is in it, and Morgan Freeman. Brilliant movie. And it didn't make Rocky numbers, but it will rip your soul out when you see it. So there's great boxing movies about that problem. The Champ, there's another one. All right, so that's what the chaotic realm is about. Everything is going negatively on the horizontal, on the surface, meaning everyday actions, and everything is going negatively on the worldview of the protagonist. Holy shit, what am I gonna do now? What am I gonna do now? Oh my God, I'm gonna die. What is it gonna mean when I die? Will anybody give a shit? Holy crap, what have I been doing with my life? Well, I gotta go on. How am I gonna create meaning? That's it. I know I talk a little bit long, so I can go a little bit over if there are more questions.
All right, I've got another one here from Kim. Instead of a trajectory, instead of a trajectory from the hero going from one worldview to a new one, does a story work if it has a protagonist whose gift has already been established, although it's still forming? But he loses himself at the beginning of the story and then rediscovers himself at the end. He still has an existential crisis when he realizes this new life he tried on doesn't work.
Well, I mean, the first thing that came to my mind was The Color of Money, which was a sequel to The Hustler. That's more of a redemption story. The redemption story is about... It's about a character who sold their soul and they've sold their gift for, you know, on the surface, third party validation or because they have some kind of problem. So redemption stories are great. And at the beginning of the story, the worldview of the protagonist is antagonistic. So they basically have quit. So you can look at Rocky and you can say he's dead at the beginning of the story. He's quit. He's not training hard. He's smoking cigarettes in the locker room. He's just going in there because the only thing he can feel anymore is a jab to the face. And he won't release his gift until he's had the shit kicked out of him so much that he gets really angry. That's the beginning of the movie. He just gets beaten. And what? It's like Fight Club. It's like you get desensitized to the point where the only thing that you can actually legitimately and authentically feel anymore is pain. So that's not a good way to live. And it spirals downward, right? So you can begin a story with a character like that, and then into the extraordinary world is entering into a world where people don't look at the world like that. And so the kind of cynical person at the beginning of the story enters a place where people are legitimately doing their best, right? And they're getting on with it. So the anti-hero enters a world of heroic figures. So then they have that crash where, like Rocky does. Rocky has things are so fucking positive for him in midpoint that it crashes his negative worldview, right? So you're inversing the usual story where at the beginning of the story, someone's super positive, I got everything figured out. And then midpoint, they're crashed and their worldview is shattered. And it turns out that they're not really good at anything, that they've been lying to themselves. So you can do the lie, it's a lie, right? So worldview is about de-lying yourself, de-bullshitting yourself. It's the process by which we get rid of the bullshit story in our mind so that we can attune better and level up to a more real and more authentic way of life. So I think the answer to your question is, yes, that's extraordinarily compelling story. And I would look at redemption stories like The Verdict or Rocky or things like that to guide that process. And people like those too. As Good As It Gets is another one. we like those stories because we all hit that bottom and we all sort of say, fuck it, I'm just gonna do my shit and not worry about anything anymore. And you know you can't keep doing that. And you do it for a while. And then you see The Verdict and you go, I gotta get out there. I gotta stop playing video games all day.
All right, I got one more here. Okay. All right, this is about the hero's journey 2.0 as well. Throughout the journey, the hero interacts with a force that was described as the luminous. We have also discussed in the past that there is both
the numinous.
No, Lou. All right. L. Yeah.
Oh, that. Yeah, they misread it. It's the numinous, not the luminous.
Okay.
All right. So go ahead. I'm sorry. I lost my train of thought.
We have also discussed in the past that there is both an external story and an internal story. So the external would be something like action, internal would be character growth and perception, wisdom, etc. Would it be fair statement that the numinous mostly impacts the internal story?
No.
Okay.
The numinous, the numinous is, a philosophical place that can be both externalized and internalized. So the numinous is what Immanuel Kant came up with. And what he put forward, I don't want to get into all the stuff from which he built it, but that there are things about every object and subject in the world we can never really know, right? Because there's a thing in itself that is unknowable. So just to make an analogy, in contemporary life today, a lot of people walk around and say, you don't know what I've gone through in my life. Therefore, until you do, you can't make any statements or judgments or inferences about what might could be good or bad for me. And that's kind of what Kant was getting at. But I disagree about the second part of that statement. So the thing in itself is the unknown unknowns, right? And in fact, each and every one of us has this within us, right? We're not really sure who the hell we are. We're not really sure what our essence is. This is what Heidegger was talking about. Heidegger was like, the human beings are the only things without essence. And it's our job to create our essence through pursuing sort of the heroic journey. It's meaning-making as our essence. I think that's what our essence is. I think our essence here is to make meaning, personally and intersubjectively. So that the cognitive capacity of the species increases and doesn't fragment. So the numinous is really a great concept when you want to drop in something super unexpected, right? So, but it has to be at the right time. So an example of an externally driven numinal event would be a pandemic. We don't know why, right? We don't know why. It just did. It came. And it's weird because if you look at the historical record, there have been a lot of historical events where there are these societies. Things are starting to sort of fragment a little bit, and a numinal event emerges. There's a volcano, or the Black Death, or et cetera. So the numinous can be an external event, or a monster drops in. Somebody goes crazy. Somebody does something unexpected that we never thought would be possible again. We always hear these stories about these crazy people who shoot other people, and they go, oh, he was a really nice guy. I never really expected. He was very quiet. That's a numinal event. We don't know in the heart we can't know what's going on in somebody else's mind. So internally, we can also have these moments when we hit the numinous. So what does that mean? It means when Rocky hits the fact that everybody thinks he's a dick now that he's a successful fighter and that he's got a shot at the world and nobody wants to be his friend anymore. It's a hit with the numinous. It doesn't make sense. Why would these people who were always my friends now reject me because I'm getting along okay? It doesn't make any sense. So that's another. So the numinous is all of those things. It's basically uncertainty. It's a drop-in event of things externally or internally that disturb the character. So again, do you really want to be going up to that level of abstraction when you're writing a story and saying, where's my numinal event? I don't know that you do. I really don't. I think as long as you stay grounded in a level of analysis that is very practical for you, whatever level that is, that is going to be the best approach to solve your own problems. But once you start saying, well, Sean talks about the numinous and Immanuel Kant, maybe I should read A Critique of Pure Reason to figure out what the hell he meant by the numinous. And the next thing you know, you're reading this really turgid prose from 200 years ago, and you're really getting out of the realm, right? So I think the best way to deal with the heroic journey, I'll tell you why I bring in those things, right? Because I'm writing to the 26-year-old Sean Coyne, and he's going to say, what the hell did you pull out there? Give me some proof. Where's the philosophical truth of that? Who said this before? Is that Luther or Aquinas, or who came up with that? Was that Platonic? Where does the Enlightenment figure in to this thing? So I've got a really great internal editor who's like, no. You're not going to tell me about the heroic journey unless you can level up to Immanuel Kant level of worldview, right? Immanuel, that's what all philosophy is. It's trying to figure out a workable worldview for everyone. And that's what Kant and Heidegger and Plato and Kierkegaard and all those people were doing. So you don't have to do that. You just need to know what fleshed out. And the reason why I'm doing Heroic Journey 2.0 is that Hero's Journey and Joseph Campbell's model is not workable anymore because it's too specific about acquiring a result, right? It's not about individuation. It's about a freaking result. So Jung brilliantly was like, no. It's all process. It's all individuation. It's all leveling up. How do you do that? Well, it's not about stealing the gold from the Aztecs and bringing it back to Spain or whatever. No. Now, I understand why Campbell came up with that, because it's really a practical, guidepost for a certain cultural grammar that's 70 years old, right? So don't worry about the numinous unless you really want to, but look at it after you've written your book or you're helping somebody else. I would not bring up numinous or any of that stuff with clients unless they're really into it, and just say, like, let's have that conversation offline. Let's keep focused on your book right now. Don't worry about the numinous. We need a fear gorilla to drop in here, that kind of thing.
All right, that's it.
Great. Well, this is so much fun because I get to riff on things I'm thinking about. So I can't thank all of you enough for hanging in there and being part of the guild. It's awesome. So I'm really looking forward to year two. I'm going to be less, obviously, with Tim as publisher and Leslie as editor-in-chief. I'm going to get to be able to try and satisfy the 26-year-old me more than I have over here. So thanks, everybody, and I hope to see you next year, and I'll definitely see you in December.
All right. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.